Last time, we were in Deuteronomy chapter 33 and covered the first 17 verses. And so we have the rest of 33 to do and 34 before we get over into the book of Joshua. In those 17 verses of Deuteronomy 33, we recognize that these last two chapters were very certainly not written by Moses. How do we know that? Well, the events described, some of them are about Moses' death. It's really hard to write about how your own funeral went. So when we get to that part, that will make it clear. But also, it's written in the third person. And so they're talking about Moses. And when you talk about somebody, you don't... There are people in life... I think Bob Dole was one. When you asked him a question, you go, well, Bob Dole thinks that... That is just weird. I don't know how to get any other kind of a reaction in my mind to it. We understood what they meant, but nonetheless, that's just not how you write. And so it's a recounting of Moses' last little bit of time. And we do see him being given a name by this person that's writing called Man of God. It's the first time this name shows up in the Bible. And it does show up other times in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And by context, sometimes it might mean something a little different, but many times it means a man speaking on God's behalf, and that's what we saw with Moses, and we see a recounting of the words that Moses talks about. The writer starts with talking about the mountains. There were three mountains that were a big part of the Exodus and the wandering and the preparation for going into the Promised Land, and those mountains were Sinai, Mount Seir, and Mount Paran. And of course, Sinai played a big role. It's where the burning bush was, and then that's where God brought Moses and the Israelites back to. And then we see God in some of his most significant actions and forms. He descends on the mountain as a cloud. There's thunder, there's lightning. He speaks audibly to Moses where the people can hear it. There's a lot going on. Moses is called up on the mountain multiple times. In one of those times, the law is given, and the law is engraved on stones. And, of course, we know the stories about how all that came together and breaking the original stones and the worship of the golden calf and all those things. Mount Seir and Mount Paran were both places that they were involved with things as they wandered in the 40 years. And there were often commands given, reiterating some of the laws from those locations. And it says there in the verses that he, Yahweh, came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. And we talked for a while about the role that's often mentioned about angels being a part of establishing the law. And it's not mentioned in the first five books, but it's mentioned in Acts 7, in Galatians 3, and in Hebrews 2. Very clearly talking about the angels having a role with delivering and establishing the law. And then there are words that are attributed to Moses that are recorded that says, Yahweh loves the people. It's seen in the law and the miracles that he's done, the grace, the leading, the promises. And it says the holy ones are in his hand and they follow your steps and keep your commands. And so God is definitely showing his love for the people in how he has working with them. And also it talks about the law being a possession for them, a possession of Jacob. And certainly the law is internalized. They recognize the law is given specifically to them. But also then it becomes a valued part of who they are. When they do turn to God and look, the law serves a very significant purpose of directing them in their approach back to God or their approach in following God, making vows and those kinds of things. Also caused Moses, a king of Jeshurun. And Jeshurun means upright one. And certainly, functionally, Moses did act as a king, not as in a formal role, but in his functional activities. He provided the direction for the people of Israel, and through it was through him that God chose to communicate his laws and those kinds of things. In verse 6, it begins a passage of prayers, prophecies, and mandates for the various tribes. And so we covered verses 6 through 17, Reuben, Judah, Levi, Benjamin, and Joseph. Reuben was the firstborn, and he's the first one mentioned, but it doesn't follow any birth order beyond that. And so I'm going to hit a few highlights out of that. When he's talking about Judah, Judah has emerged after Reuben and Simeon's great sin. Reuben was the firstborn, Simeon was the second, but they took violent revenge against the city of Shechem because of the mistreatment of their sister by men in the city. And Jacob was not pleased with that. It was not a God-directed revenge. And so they diminished. Simeon also had his own sin, but Judah emerged because he stood up and took responsibility for his sins with regard to his own daughter-in-law. And here Moses says, hear his voice. It's a prayer for him with regard to his role amongst the people. And it shows his emergence. Also, David, King David and King Jesus will both come out of the tribe of Judah. There's also quite a little bit about priestly role of the Levites. And God prays that Yahweh will accept their ministry. And he also asks for their protection. Also for Benjamin, Moses calls out for security for him. And then he talks about Joseph a fair amount, talks about him being blessed. And we know that when we talk about Joseph in terms of the settlement, Joseph will receive his inheritance through his sons Ephraim and Manasseh. And he calls Joseph blessed, the choice of heaven. He wishes for him material prosperity and favor from him who lives in the bush. Who lives in the bush? Well, that would go back to Mount Sinai and Yahweh. Talks about Joseph receiving a distinguished crown and talks about military success, that they will be horns driving people. And of course, he talks about Ephraim was to be the greater, even though he was the younger, and talked about him having 10,000s and Manasseh having his thousands. And so that's a real brief discussion about what we covered last week in the first part of chapter 33. Before we go on after class, and usually I would say, bring your questions during class. They're going to want to hear it. I was kind of glad in a way, I don't even remember now. It was you? Yeah, you brought me that. Kind of glad in a way this one came after class, because it took a little bit of, not painstakingly, but it took a little bit of research. If you look down at verse 6 of Deuteronomy 33, it says this. It says this in the New American Standard. May Reuben live and not die, nor his men be few. Now, you can look at particularly the English Standard Version is going to be, there are two versions that do that differently, and the English Standard Version is going to be the one that's most popular in this crowd where it says something different. It will say something like this. I didn't write down the exact words. May Reuben live and not die, and let him have few men, or let his men be few, or not have many men. So ESV is a good translation. On the side of what the New American Standard, the direction they went, were and do not let his men be few. The King James, the New King James, the New International Version, the New American Standard, both the 20 and 95 versions, the Legacy Standard, the New English Translation, the Revised Standard Version, the American Standard Version, they all do it like the New American Standard did. But here's how we get the problem. And it's a challenge when they decide to translate this. Because of the way the Hebrew's constructed, it's real clear about the first part. Let Reuben live and not die. You almost can't bring variations into that legitimately. but in the last part, and not let his men be few. Well, that one we can get some variation, because I'll do it the way I would do it as a guy working algebra, and not let his men be few. If that not goes with all of this, okay, that's one thing. But, and not, well, I wrote this up here poorly. Now I'm going to have trouble putting it back together. And not, oh, I know what I did wrong. It's this not. We know not die, and does that and mean, does that not apply not only to not die, too many ands now, does that apply only to not die, or does it apply to not die and not let his men be few? And there really isn't, in the opinion of the people I looked at, a clear, for sure way to bring that forward from the Hebrew to other languages. It's not just a problem for English, it's a problem for how does the sentence construction intended to read? How much does the not go with? And obviously you can see that the bulk of the people, when they did translations, went the way that the New American Standard did, and put the not to apply to this as well. But that's not a for sure. What caused the ESV to kind of go its own way? They're not the only one. What's the CSB? Somebody know? Christian Standard Bible. The Christian Standard Bible also went the same way that the English Standard Version went, and did not apply, I'm going to have so many knots in this sentence, but did not apply the not to the other side of the and.
It used but.
But let his men be few.
But let his men be few.
It doesn't make sense it would roll into that, because if they don't want him to die, why would they want him to have few people?
Well, but that's what we're left with. Is you, I'm not making fun of what you said. What the translators are left with is going, how do we make sense out of this? Which is essentially putting what you said in question form. And most of them went this way. But it's a great question. When we see things like that, we ought to run it down. And when we get all done, we at least know they had to make a decision. We may or may not agree with their decision. Yes, sir. Well, and I'm not going to say that's necessarily wrong. See, the other challenge that we've got going here is this analysis really has to happen in Hebrew, not English. And I don't have much Hebrew. If it was Greek, I probably at least learned enough that I could look more things up. But I don't have any Hebrew, formal Hebrew learning. And so, yeah. Anyway, I wanted to bring it to you that some of you are going to have a different translation, and here's why. It's trying to make sense out of the sentence construction. And I can't come and, in Greek, I could talk to you about things they leave out in Greek. And then I could tell you in Hebrew, I know this, they leave out the vowels. There are no vowels in Hebrew. So that's why, is it Yahweh or Jehovah? We have to guess. But I don't know about sentence construction. And they talked a little bit about sentence construction, but didn't get into any detail, so I can't regurgitate that to you. So.
How much does the translation from the Hebrew into the Septuagint?
Well, they have the same problems. Now, I don't know what they did with the Septuagint. I could have looked. I didn't look for the LXX. But when I was comparing versions, of course, my problem is if they went to the, when we go to the Septuagint, now I'm going to have to go back and translate the Septuagint Because when they're going to tell me how they did it in Septuagint Greek or they're Greek. Then I'd have to go back and get my Greek books out to see how they handled it in Greek. I don't think that's possible. I don't even think I could find all my Greek books anymore. But, and then, you know, I learned one really important thing taking 3 years of Greek and Koine Greek, biblical Greek in college. Translators are way better at it than I'll ever have a hope of being. So I'm not going to try to be the smart one in the room. I'm going to use what I can find out about why the translators went the directions they did. Anyway, I wanted to bring this before you. And when I say the next thing, you're going to know that I don't have any answers. But any questions or additional comments? I mean, I went a reasonable distance with it. I mean, if I wanted to spend a couple weeks, I probably could have.
So we really don't know if it's let his men be few or have a lot of men.
Or let his men not be few. Yeah, that's right. We really don't know. Yes, sir. It is.
If you look at numbers 1 and 2, he had 46,000 some men. So if you just look at the evidence, Reuben could have died because of his sin.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. And God could have taken him out of the inheritance. Instead of giving 46,000 and some men. So I think it's
yeah.
And have a lot of men, and they didn't live.
Yeah.
That's what the evidence of Scripture says.
Yeah, I think you're right in applying the grace of God is seen. And, you know, if we didn't believe in the grace of God, this Exodus wouldn't have ever happened if there wasn't. Maybe, let me say that differently. It doesn't matter what we believe. If God, in reality, wasn't full of grace, These Israelites would not have survived their own failings in the Exodus. It just wouldn't have happened. I mean, there would have probably been a remnant, and we would have seen how big the remnant was, and those few hundred maybe, I don't know, maybe thousands, but it wouldn't have been the big group of people that they were that actually completed the Exodus and found their way into the Promised Land. Somebody start to say something? You know, I've had reason to reflect on this in my own life recently. And as I get older, I my thoughts tend to go back to the years and go through all of the really, mostly I would say embarrassing, but I could also quickly say and correctly sinful responses that I made that I didn't even realize at the time were what they were. And some days it really kind of gets me down a little bit, to be honest. But, you know, the grace of God is just phenomenal. You know, I did the dumbest sinful things that you can imagine. Didn't even know I was doing it. And then later on you go, wow, I never even thought. You know, some conversation will come back to mind that I haven't even thought about for 40 years and go, oh, no wonder that person got mad at me. Look what I did. I didn't even realize it at the time. And those things just, the grace of God is just beyond grasping. And then we listen to sermons like what Dave taught last week. The grace of God's just, his patience is just beyond any human description we could make or relate to it. We would never have the patience that God has had with people like us. Good point. What else? Well, let's go ahead with our look at chapter 33, and I'm going to read verses 18 through 25 to continue on from where we were. Of Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going forth, and Issachar, in your tents. They will call peoples to the mountain. There they will offer righteous sacrifices, for they will draw out the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand." Of Gad, he said, "Blessed is the one who enlarges Gad. He lies down as a lion and tears the arm, also the crown of the head. Then he provided the first part for himself, for there the ruler's portion was reserved. And he came with the leaders of the people. He executed the justice of the Lord and his ordinances with Israel." Of Dan, he said, "Dan is a lion's whelp that leaps forth from Bashan." Of Naphtali, he said, "O Naphtali, satisfied with favor and full of the blessings of the Lord, take possession of the sea in the south." Of Asher, he said, "More blessed than sons is Asher. May he be favored by his brothers, and may he dip his foot in oil. Your locks will be iron and bronze according to your days, and so will your leisurely walk be. There is none like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to your help, and through the skies in his majesty. The eternal God is a dwelling place." I went too far. I was going to stop at 25. So we'll go back and look at verses 18 through 25. Zebulun was the 10th born, and he told Zebulun to rejoice in your going out and in your travels and in your conquests. Clearly, he's looking forward to Zebulun as one who will be moving to and fro in the promised land, and Issachar will be in their tents, and they're going to call peoples to the mountain. They're going to offer righteous sacrifices. So they're going to be leading people in the righteous way, and they'll draw the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. Zebulun are going to be great traders and profitable and prosperous in the new land. He calls the people to think of Gad and says, "Blessed is the one who enlarges Gad." Gad is going to be a mighty warrior. He lays down as a lion and tears the arm and also the crown of the head. And he says he provides the first part for himself. The ruler's portion was reserved. And so he's going to be in a leadership role. He's going to come with the leaders of the people. He's going to be a part of executing the justice of the Lord and for upholding the ordinances of Israel that have been given. He talks about Dan, said Dan is a lion's whelp and goes to the power of the lion. He leaps forth from Bashan. Of Naphtali, he said, be satisfied with favor, full of the blessing of the Lord. Take possession of the sea in the south. And Naphtali will be down in the southern, near the ocean part, and they will make a lot of their living out of the sea and be taking profit, taking sustenance from the sea. And he talked about Asher well. He said he's more blessed than sons and may be favored by his brothers, looking for good relationships with Asher, and dip his foot in oil. And so oil was a big part of their agricultural operations, and so he was going to be one that would be part of harvesting the oil, and that would be a part of his future. Your locks will be iron and bronze according to your day. So will your leisurely walk be. He's going to be a powerful man, strong. And he says, there's none like the God of Jeshurun, the God of uprightness. I'm sorry, I've moved past chapter 25 again. And yes, there's a lot that, we could work at relating to these men. I really hesitated to try to take the time to do that. Really want to move our study forward and get into the book of Joshua. But it's clear that as the writer is recording the thoughts and prayers and wishes of Moses forward about these men, he's looking forward to their roles in the promised land and seeing them be successful. And they are very successful for a time until they turn their face away from the Lord. Questions, comments? Well, let's then move on to the last part here, verses 26 through 29. And so here is Moses being recorded as wrapping it up. There's none like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to your help, and through the skies in his majesty. The eternal God is a dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And he drove out the enemy from before you, and he said, destroy. So Israel dwells in security, the fountain of Jacob secluded, in a land of grain and new wine. His heavens also drop down dew. Blessed are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, who is the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty. So your enemies will cringe before you, and you will tread upon their high places. And so Moses looks out and paints this image of God for them that is very accurate about what he has done and what he is ready and waiting to do in their conquest of the land of Canaan. There's no one like them. No one has this upright God, the God of Jeshurun. And this God is in the heavens, and verse 27, but he himself is a dwelling place. He's saying, abide in God. God is your shelter, and underneath are everlasting arms to support you and to care for you. He drove out the enemy from before you, which certainly happened there east of the Jordan. The Amorites were easily defeated, and that land taken for 2.5 tribes. And then Moses said, here's in the last part of verse 27, and said, destroy. That's going to be their command going forward as they move into the promised land. So Israel dwells in security. The fountain of Jacob, secluded. The fountain of Jacob, they're headed into the promised land. That's where Jacob's fountain is. In a land of grain and new wine, very prosperous, very much into a big harvest. His heavens also drop down dew. The rains, the sustenance come from heaven. The dews come from heaven. God is caring for them out of the heavens. Verse 29, blessed are you, O Israel. Who is like you? A people saved by Yahweh. And there isn't another people saved by Yahweh. He's wanting them to recognize their special place in God's heart, in his mind, his love, and his plans for them. Who is the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty? He's wanting them to look to God. What's their temptation going to be? Look to themselves and think they are the might that's doing all this. And he says, out of this greatness of the Lord, who is saving you, shielding you, is your sword. In the last part of 29, so your enemies will cringe before you. God is going to create a great fear because of his great actions. And you will tread upon their high places. What are their high places? What does that mean? Their places of worship. You're going to walk underfoot the places that these folks worshiped. Questions, thoughts? Okay, well, let's go over to chapter 34. And I'm going to start with verses 1 through 12. Now, it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, cross this Jordan. I'm sorry. I looked down on the wrong page. Let's go back and read chapter 34. That's Joshua 1. I really want to get to Joshua. I can't wait to get there. Sorry. Now Moses, chapter 34. Now Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, and the Negev, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as the Zoar. Then the Lord said to him, "This is the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'I will give it to your descendants.' I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." So Moses, a servant of the Lord, died there in this land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in the valley of the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, but no man knows his burial place to this day. Although Moses was one of 120 years old when he died, Although Moses was 120 years old when he died, his eye was not dim, nor his vigor abated. So the sons of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses came to an end. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses has laid his hands on him, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Since that time, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. For all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land, and for all the mighty power and for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. So Moses, as he was directed by God, goes up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. It's right there on the plains. This mountain is there. And the Lord showed him all the land. Now, let's not get confused. Can you see further when you go up higher? Yeah, a little bit, but not much. I've had a privilege, some of you may, probably all of you have had, but I've done it and thinking about things like this. I can tell you from 5,000 feet in an airplane, you can't see Kansas City from here. These are the distances we're talking about Moses seeing, is a couple hundred miles in places. You can't see a couple hundred miles. You might be able to, you start around 10,000 feet, you might be able to start seeing it, but you really don't see it. You can kind of tell it's fuzzy out there. Okay, so Moses is at the top of this mountain, and what is he seeing? Well, the Lord showed him all the land. He was able to see Gilead as far as Dan. We're on the western side of the Promised Land. Naphtali and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh and Judah as far as the Western Sea. So he's looking as far as the Mediterranean Sea while he's on this mountain. And then he gets to look quite a ways over to the southwest, to the Negev, the plain of the Valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. And so God is showing him all this. Much like when he told Abraham, get up, walk around, look it all over. Everywhere you walk, I've given you. Well, Moses didn't get to walk around, but God took him on a visual tour and said, this is the land I'm giving to them. This is a miracle that God is doing to let him see it. And it's letting Moses see the imminent fulfillment of a promise. That all these lands, as far as you can see, Abraham, are going to be yours. Promise is repeated for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and is still alive today because it's to you and your descendants that he made these promises to the patriarchs. And so he gets to see it there. I've let you see it with your eyes, but you don't get to go. And so in verse 5, Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And verse 6 is kind of fascinating, and we're going to spend some time here. And he buried him in the valley of the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, but no man knows the burial place to this day. Let's start here. And he buried him. Who's the he? God. Yes. Now, let's look into that just a little bit. And here's a place to go to start our look. Go to Jude, verse 9. And this is going to create a little bit of a conversation about a couple other things too. Jude verse 9 says this. Oh, wait, I hear the pages turning yet. Jude verse 9. But Michael, the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Now, the purpose of what Jude put here in verse 9 was to talk about the role of, here's Michael the archangel, even though he was the highest angel, when he was having a dispute with Satan, didn't personally do the rebuke. He said, "Let the Lord rebuke you." In other words, Michael was not going to take God's role of pronouncing judgment on Satan. But what's going on in the background is worth talking about a little bit. Because what is he talking about? Disputing about, argued about, the body of Moses. And so it gives the potential appearance here, and we're going to talk about some other inputs to this, but certainly gives the appearance here that, yes, God did it, but Michael, the archangel, was probably the one involved as an angel carrying out the orders to go bury the body of Moses. That's highly probable that what we're talking about here. Either that or was some other time when there was a dispute over the body of Moses. Well, the fact that Jude includes this by itself is a little bit of a challenge. And why is it a challenge? Well, where does this information come from that Jude put down in his letter? And that is a crucial question. There is a man looking at it kind of question and drawing conclusions to get an answer, and that answer could be dangerous. Because there is a book out there, I say a book, it's like another, no, I don't want to say it quite that way, but it has some similarities to what we call books in the Bible. And it's in the pseudographical books, in other words, ones that have been rejected as either incorrect or false or authorship problems. In this case, it's a book called The Assumption of Moses. And it's been rejected as a book, and yet that's the other place we know of in writings where this dispute is discussed in some detail in this pseudographical work. And so this raises a question, well, is it appropriate for Jude to quote information out of a book that's been rejected as not canonical, as not part of the Bible? Well, let's make the case even a little worse. Without too much question, the Assumption of Moses was probably written shortly after the time of Christ, probably in the first century. You can even, in looking at the book, see that the author was most likely a Pharisee, because there are things in the book that are critical of the views of the Sadducees. And it's pretty clear that he was acquainted with the Maccabean movement of a revolt against Rome. And here he is writing about stuff that happened about Moses. So let's go back and answer the question. Where did Jude get the information to put in this book? What would you say? The Holy Spirit gave it to him. There are lots of things in the New Testament that are recorded by men who weren't there. Things recorded about the Old Testament. I didn't plan to do this, but let's do it. Go over to Acts chapter something. 7? I'm off. I got to find it. And it's good. You're going to have to be patient with me. See, now God's really patient. You got to be a little bit patient. Because I should have either not done this or thought about it earlier and looked it up. Well, it's in Acts 8. There is a place in there where Stephen talks about angels. We looked at it last week, I think, where Stephen talks about angels being involved in giving the law. And Stephen wasn't there. Might be. Yes.
26?
No, 38. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel who was speaking to him on Mount Sinai, who was the one with our fathers, and received living oracles to pass on to you.
Chapter 7?
I'm sorry, that is chapter 7. That's right. I was looking at the top and should have looked at the actual chapters. But we have all kinds of things, and there's examples that just aren't quickly coming to mind, of people in the New Testament talking about events that occurred in the Old Testament and bringing clarity about them. And so that's not unusual. We believe that the scriptures were written by men filled with the Holy Spirit. And so when Jude is writing, this wouldn't be here if the Holy Spirit hadn't prompted him to put these words on the page. Whether or not it was included in some apocryphal work becomes irrelevant. False books can contain some true information, right? So just because it was included there didn't mean that Jude was in error or was giving credence to that book to include this quick quote here. I don't know if I want to say it's a quote because I don't know if it's word for word, but this information that he could go back there and find it. So from the writing of Jude, we know that there was some dispute, there was some spiritual conflict going on regarding the body of Moses at some point in time. I would think it would be most likely when God had him moved to a secret burial site. And it is, there's lots of ideas about why would God hide his grave? Why would God hide his grave?
The people have already shown themselves to be idolaters.
They really are looking for something to worship, aren't they?
You also look at how Islam treats Muhammad the prophet, and so there's a tendency of us to worship people, and I think we see that in our day and age too. There's a tendency for us to worship people rather than God, even if they're messengers from God. And so I think that's one reason why he might have hidden his body.
You know, we probably could get into some strange conversation here that I don't want to make it strange, but I've had a question that doesn't have to do with the validity of the Shroud of Turin, but has to do with, why is it important to so many people? What's the big deal?
They need something physical.
But if, as no matter which way the argument seems to be going at the time, I mean, people either want to worship it or throw it away. And I don't care about the throwing it away, but worshiping it would be wrong. And so, yes, God was isolating Moses and his grave from being something that the people could go back to and make a shrine out of or worship in and of itself. Michael the Archangel is an interesting character. In Daniel's chapter 10 and 12, he's talked about as one who watches over Israel. In Revelation 12, it talks about him leading the holy angels. Let's go over to Daniel chapter 8, just to get a feel for Michael the archangel for just a minute that Jude mentions in this fight over Moses' body. Daniel chapter 10 is where I want to go. Went too far. Getting there. I'm going to read verses 8 through 15 if I ever get to Daniel 10. Gives us a picture. Now, Daniel's in the middle of getting some really gut-wrenching revelations from God during this time. And he's upset, full of terror. And frankly, what he was looking at was the end times. He didn't get to put it, write it down. But let me start in 10:8. I'm going to read down through 15. Daniel speaking. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face with my face to the ground. Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I am about to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on your humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Now I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision pertains to the days yet future. And when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. So this angel clearly was sent to Daniel to bring him information and comfort in the midst of these visions. But he said, I was held up for 21 days by this battle with the kings of Persia, in the area of the kings of Persia. But Michael the archangel came and freed me from this battle that lasted 3 weeks. That's an interesting picture of the kinds of things that are going on in a world not visible to us. In a spiritual world where there is no question marks, there are no uncertainties. Is God's will going to be fully done and completed? Yes, it always has been and it always will be. And yet there's a battle with the evil forces of Satan, even in the heavenly places. And Paul said, our battle's not flesh against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities and strongholds in heavenly places. And so it's not the physical battles that are the main ones. It is the battles that go on in the spiritual world, and they affect mankind in many ways. Any questions or comments so far? So let's go on. In verse 8, it says that Israel wept 30 days on the plain of Moab. So at Moses' death, they wept. And they had good reason to weep in many ways, because a chapter was closing in the life of the nation of Israel that God had preserved, of the people he had brought out of Egypt, of the sojourn they made, the miracles along the way, the giving of the law, the establishing of them in ways that go beyond just the fact that they were born out of 12 brothers, but establishing them as a people of God with a law given by God, accountability to God, assurances from God, and words written by Moses for them to live by. And so that chapter is closing. As they look at it, they have to realize, if they've got eyes to see and ears to hear, which Moses said God had not given them yet, but for those that could see and hear, they had to know what an experience those people had been through, how much God had preserved them, and what kinds of hopes they could have as they obeyed him moving forward. So after the 30 days, in verse 9, it says, Joshua was filled with the spirit of wisdom. Moses had laid hands on him. And looking back, my bookmark fell out, but looking back, in 34:9, said this, after, in the last part of the verse, Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. For that one brief moment at least, but that's the starting point going into the promised land, they're listening to Joshua. And they were doing as Jehovah or Yahweh had commanded them through Moses. And then verse 10 is the epitaph for Moses. Since that time, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses. And what is the most key factor about who Moses was that we've seen all the way through the book of Exodus, all the way through what we looked at in Numbers, and what we've looked at here in the book of Deuteronomy? The Lord knew him face to face. Like one friend would know another, it said in one of the passages, about Moses' face-to-face relationship to God. And so the Lord knew him face-to-face. That's not happened at the time of this writing since. Obviously, when Jesus was here, he had an even greater than face-to-face relationship with the Father. But in terms of for these Old Testament leaders, and so the Lord knew him face to face. They also, no one has risen like Moses for all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, against all of his servants and all of his land, and for all the mighty power and for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. When you think about the mighty acts of God, the mighty proclamations of God, and the mighty grace of God seen throughout the life of Moses, it is absolutely, utterly astounding. There are other great times in the scriptures where God did great things through men. God did great things despite men. God did great things to redeem men. And of course, when we get to the New Testament, Moses is eclipsed by Christ most clearly and certainly. But this was an indescribable time to have been part of the kingdom of God. Questions, comments, thoughts? Let me look back and see where Moses said this. Back about 29, I think. And maybe I can't just turn to it. I guess I can't. But Moses makes the statement, God has not yet given you eyes to see and ears to hear. When you look at the scriptures we've been through, and I look back, we were doing Genesis, and we were partway through Genesis I'm going to get the date wrong, 22. We've been doing this a long time, and it's been a good, rich time for me. I hope it has been for you. But when you look back at everything that happened in this time of the Exodus and the time of them being freed from Egypt and up till now, doesn't that statement just have the super ring of truth to it? These people didn't have eyes to see or ears to hear. Because this ending here in Deuteronomy says, in chapter 34 here, the last verse, the last words, for all the mighty power and for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. They could be given grace one day and rebel against Moses and Aaron the next. They didn't have ears to hear and eyes to see. When we understand the scriptures, we ought to be thanking the Lord. Because ears to hear and eyes to see only come from God. Well, unless you have something to add, that's all I have. We have one more week before we take a break for a couple Christmas Sundays, a couple of Sundays in the Christmas holiday period. So next week we'll introduce ourselves to the book of Joshua.